title of this, from what I noticed this morning, was on a flyer downstairs. And it's got something to do with quasi-particles in two dimensions with both massive and massless character. And the actual mathematical part of this is pretty brief. So what I'm going to do is to spend a few minutes telling you about how it arose, the kinds of real materials we were studying when this arose. It's got absolutely nothing to do, I think, even the types of materials, nothing to do with the mathematical problem or the physical behavior here. It could be found in other materials. So I'll just acknowledge who's been working on this. It was in some calculations that Victor Fardo, a research associate who's just gone back to Spain a couple weeks ago for a few months, calculations he was doing. And then I got Rajiv and Swapno Banerjee, students here, involved in trying to understand some of the implications of this situation we encountered. And so this started in our study of oxides, and I see the words got around a little further than I had known about. Some oxides and some what seems like some rather simple considerations, and actually is involves some really interesting physics in these oxides, which I will just mention some of the problems. I won't give you any of the results. And then this new sort of electronic state, electronic structure that we came across. So this study arose from the fact that in the early 2000s, around 2002, one group and then some other groups began to find that they could use pulsed laser deposition to deposit oxide materials layer by layer. Actually, another group or two had known a decade earlier that you could use some other methods, which are slower and more expensive, to produce these. But this is just a transmission electron microscopy picture of one of these samples. They were just growing what they decided to grow. And you see some sorts of layers here. This is lanthanum aluminate, strontium titanate, I think, but it doesn't matter. But if you get right up into this little area right here and blow it up, you see layer by layer what's happening. And in that particular layer, or that particular region, what they were doing was growing five layers of strontium titanate and then one layer of lanthanum. That's here. And then strontium titanate and lanthanum. And discovering that this can be done fairly precisely. People are still deciding what fairly precisely means. But these ionic materials, when you play around with them, they become more interesting than usual because of their polar nature. That is, you can get layers that are charged and alternate layers that are charged alternately. And this can be manipulated within some limits. And when you try to violate those limits, and the charge has to do something besides what the formal charge on these ions would indicate, then interesting things happen. That's referred to as electronic reconstruction, whatever happens. So this is just a blow up of that little region. Here's a lanthanum oxide layer here, every sixth layer. And you can see they're pretty abrupt. Now just how perfect this is, just how many strontiums might be over here. What we're looking at here is actually electrons fired through a very thin sample, 200-400 angstroms thick, single crystalline sample, and these are images of the columns of atoms. And here, I won't spend any time here really, I'm just indicating here that you can use this same technique, transmission electron microscopy, to resolve. You resolve the energies after the electrons come through the sample and do electron energy loss studies. And here it's going through a sample of strontium titanate and two layers of lanthanum aluminate, I think. Or it could be, lanthanum titanate, and then back to strontium titanate. And the point is that the change in spectra here can be fit in terms of the spectra. This is core level energies of the titanium ion, and it can be fit as a linear combination of titanium 4+, which is what occurs just in the normal insulator, strontium titanate, and titanium 3+, which is what occurs in the Mott insulator, lanthanum titanate, indicating there seems to be two different charge states. It's not an average charge state in this region, which it would be if it were really a simple metallic state in there. So let me just... But all of these columns are the same. So the first question that was addressed here was, what happens if you take strontium titanate, which has formally neutral layers, titanium 4+, oxygen 2-, strontium 2+, formally neutral layers, and realistically neutral layers, and then change at some point to lanthanum titanate, lanthanum aluminate here, which has charge layers, net plus charge, net minus, plus minus. And if you make if you have a thick layer of this and a thick layer of that, then what you find, if you count electrons, is that there's an extra 1/2 electron per interface unit cell here compared to what these formal valences say the ions would like to have. And that's the question. What happens there? Well, this is one termination. You can get a different termination from the same pair of materials, and there's an extra 1/2 hole per interface unit cell. And I'll just mention that the early results said that this N-type interface is conducting, and the P-type interface is insulating. Well, don't need to pay too much attention to the rest of this. In fact, that's not right. That's an oversimplification. And just get the whole picture here. What was only found 3 or 4 years later by 4 or 5 groups checking things out is that conductivity they were seeing. So this is a sheet resistance versus temperature. This is a metallic conductivity that they originally saw. But as these groups investigated the role of the background pressure of oxygen when they were growing these materials, so instead of using 10 to the minus 6 torr of oxygen pressure, which is a little bit of oxygen in your vacuum cell, if you go to 10 to the minus 3, then you get insulating material, and you get magnetism. And in between, you get superconductivity. And everybody agrees that these are cleaner than this, so that conductivity was a bit of a red herring. It's a very interesting red herring. But these are the kinds of things that are being investigated in this area. Now, let me mention sort of the next step up, and that is, so going away from isolated interfaces to this now is a strontium titanate substrate, as thick as you wish. That's the most common substrate to use to grow materials on top of. If you grow one unit cell of lanthanum aluminate, what you get is in the LaO layer, you get the surface charge density of one sign, and the AlO2 layer, you get the surface charge density of the other sign. This gives rise to an electric field right here. And then once you're through there, it's neutral. But the next layer, you have an electric field like this, and so forth. And if you integrate that electric field, you see that the potential is ramping up like that. And, in fact, if you just consider the single charge on each of these sublayers of lanthanum aluminate, what you find is that if you just consider bare charges, this ramping charge would be 100 electron volts for five layers, or 20 electron volts for one layer. And yet, experimentalists are managing to grow a few layers of this on strontium titanate and still have an insulating system. So this 100 electron volts, or this 20 electron volts per layer, is getting screened very strongly. The band gap of lanthanum aluminate is just over 5 eV, and so it can't withstand a... So what you're setting up is a dipole layer between here and here. This is the interface, this is the surface, and as long as that situation is maintained, then the surface is coupled to the interface. They're not independent. Now, if you do that enough times, this potential difference is going to be so large that the extra half an electron per unit cell at the surface is going to want to get to the interface. That's the electronic reconstruction in this system. And it's still an open question how this happens. So I have just one more figure here before we get onto the real topic here. This is actually, as of this morning, we just got the proofs from PRL. This is the work with Rosica Pancheva, who was on that first view graph. I didn't mention her name. This is work with her. And you can see, this is a strontium titanate substrate. I put the positions of atoms over here. And we've done one unit cell of lanthanum aluminate, 3, 4, and 5. But you can see everything happening from the 5 situation here. And so this picture only shows 4, but there's another layer up here, like this, of lanthanum aluminate. And there's a little bit of electronic screening, but this is still insulating. Yet the electrons can't move very much. And what happens is that the ions displace considerably from their position, especially the lanthanum. And it's all this screening just from the ions moving, not the electrons moving with respect to the ions so much. It's just the ions responding to this bare electric field. And it turns the bare electric field, which would be of the order of 100 electron volts, into something. You can see this electric field ramping up here. This is the oxygen 2p spectrum, density of states, there. This is the Fermi level. These are occupied, these are unoccupied. Just look at the darkened regions here. And you can see that at this point, this is where our calculation says that this electronic reconstruction is just about to occur. That is, you're about to get, well, you do have oxygen p states at the surface here, 20 angstroms away from these titanium d states, which are unfilled, and it's going to be advantageous for you to get electron transfer here. But if you turn this 90 degrees backwards, you would see that there's a 2 electron volt barrier here for an electron getting through this band gap. It's 20 angstroms wide. So it's an interesting question. What's going to happen when you put on another layer and the system starts to reconstruct electronically? Well, that's where we are with that problem. And Victor Pardo began doing calculations actually a year ago on a related system, which is vanadium O2 and titanium O2. This is a standard insulator, just an ionic band insulator, and this is a correlated electron material which undergoes a metal insulator transition at 340 degrees Kelvin. But the real point is here that both of these are just 4 plus ions. Vanadium has 5 electrons, so when it's 4 plus, it still has 1d electron, but there's no polar discontinuity. across the interface between these two materials. So this could be a boring system. Here, I won't go into this, just mention this interfaces here and the growth of one on the other have been studied already in the early 90s, and it's beginning to be studied again more recently. So it's a system which is subject to being made and studied, made cleanly and studied. So the result. So here, what I'm going to do is focus on a particular situation where it's 5 titanium O2 unit cells. These are two-dimensional layers. And then 3 vanadium O2 cells, and this is repeated indefinitely. But in fact, the valence electrons here, which are on the vanadium, are two-dimensional. There's enough titanium dioxide here to confine those to 2 dimensions. And if you just look at the valence density that results, you see those electrons indeed stay on the vanadiums. So each of these unit cells contain 2 of the metal atoms. So there's 1, 2, 3 unit cells of vanadium O2 here. And there are 3 different types of ions. This vanadium against this interface is equivalent to that one over there against that interface. V2 is equivalent to this one, and V3 in the center, 3 different ions. And they each have 1 orbital occupied by 1 electron, and it's a magnetic spin-polarized electron. So there's interesting orbital ordering. You see different types of orbitals ordered there. But that's interesting, but it's not a big deal. So is it boring? And it's not boring because of the kind of electronic structure that results. So let me just mention, for those of you not in condensed matter in here, that the electrons in solids are quantized, the electron states are quantized, and the functions of the momentum, and so you plot those energy states as a function of momentum, you get things like this called the band structure. And because the real space lattice is periodic, we're paying attention to the periodicity really in two-dimensional layer, then reciprocal space, momentum space, is also periodic. So this is showing what this band structure looks like around the region in 2 dimensions, which is called the Brillouin zone, like this. This is the origin. And in terms of the lattice constant A, which we'll just take be equal to 1, then it goes out to pi 0, 0 minus pi, minus pi 0, and 0 pi. That's the region of momentum space. That's of interest. These energies are just periodic beyond that. And what is being done here is to plot these bands along this direction, then along that direction, then along that direction. Okay, which covers the energy dispersion relation has square symmetry. So that covers all the high symmetry directions. And so we looked at where bands cross the Fermi energy. And there's none along this direction or this direction, but 2 bands cross the Fermi energy somewhere along this direction, and they cross it at exactly the same place, which looks like an accident. So we got to considering where the Fermi surface would likely be here. And for there to be any Fermi surface, just to be a point here and nothing over here, it would have to, I don't know, look something like this. Okay? Which, as far as I know, doesn't happen. Be a big accident. Of course, what does happen is a little bit of an accident, because what happens is that there's just a Fermi point there. And the Fermi level falls right at this position as sort of a topological requirement. below that point, six bands are filled everywhere. There are six electrons to stick in there. And above there, all the states are filled. The Fermi level has to fall right where those cross. So that's why that happens in that way. So we began looking a little bit more carefully at this region, and blowing up or looking at the energy surfaces right around this point, ignore the second half of this plot. Because it's two-dimensional, that's just a copy of the left-hand side. Then along this direction, along the 1-1 direction, the velocity, you can see here, sort of like this, is linear here and linear here. You can see that already on the plot. But if you look at the velocity this way, it is quadratic. Okay? You can see it in the green one, and I'll show you a model that makes it clearer. So that's the kind of energy relationship we find around this point Fermi surface. It's actually four symmetry-related point Fermi surfaces. So when one looks, finds what really the energy dispersion looks like, it has this kx squared over 2m, like a massive particle. Kx squared over 2m, and then that squared, and then this is like a massless particle, a velocity, which is just the slope of that line, times ky, that quantity squared, and the square root of all that, with a plus or minus sign out front. So massive in one direction, and massless in the other, perpendicular direction, in two dimensions. Well, the point Fermi surface is something that's been given a lot of attention in the last 3 or 4 years since it was discovered that graphene could be peeled off layer by layer from graphite and studied, isolated. And graphene has a point Fermi surface, actually two related point Fermi surfaces. Just a 3-minute background on that. This is the graphene lattice. There are two atoms in the unit cell. If you take two of these atoms, say green and red like this, with two direct lattice vectors from here to here and from here to here, say, you can use those and all combinations of those to tile the whole two-dimensional lattice. So it's a hexagonal lattice, and you calculate the band structure when you put carbon atoms there, and you get a band structure that looks like this. And this occurs at the brown zone edge. And I guess there's a picture of that on the next here. The brown zone, corresponding figure to this, when you have a hexagonal lattice, is hexagonal also. And these points that this occurs at actually are on the edges, the corners of the brown zone. And graphene, and you get these circular cross sections of energy surfaces, which correspond to these cones that come out above and below this so-called Dirac point in graphene. And this is just a slide from some colleagues at Los Alamos. I've used two or three of their slides. They're just making the point that if you have a massive particle in relativistic theory, you get a dispersion relation that looks like this. Now this V, I think, they probably mean that should be a C. But if the mass is zero, then you get the kind of dispersion relation that you get here. And one thing that's handy to do is to make a simpler model of the band structure you can that has the essential aspects. That's usually the tight binding model. And here, based on the two atoms in unit cell, atom 1 and atom 2, you just consider nearest neighbor hopping, then your Hamiltonian matrix becomes a trigonometric relationship here, which corresponds to hopping from sublattice A to sublattice B. And the complex conjugate, which is hopping the other direction, that's a 2 by 2 Hamiltonian. You diagonalize that, and you get the Dirac behavior, coming out of the two independent points, K and K prime. They're symmetry related, but they're not equivalent by translational symmetry in the graphene problem. So there is what the assortment of Dirac cones looks like in graphene. And now, coming back to our problem, we've called this semi-Dirac. For want of a better name, it's Dirac along one direction, and it's more normal along the other direction, which makes it rather peculiar. Well, there's a minimum model for this that gives this kind of behavior. You consider three orbitals in unit cell. It's a square unit cell. We don't need to worry about where the orbitals are, because we're going to have orbital A just hopping to orbital A in neighboring cells, orbital B hopping to orbital B in neighboring cells. One with a dispersion goes one way, so I have a positive T here. The other one's dispersion the other way. It could be a T prime. That's not, they don't have to be the same. And then another orbital, which is a little bit distant. So we don't have to worry about its dispersion. But if the coupling is such that, so this is just here, here, and this is the third orbital, which is just out of the way. And if A and B are not coupled to each other by reasons of symmetry, but are coupled to the third orbital in such a way that the hopping along the x direction is t prime, but the hopping along the y direction is minus t prime. There's just a phase relationship. Again, that's telling something about the relative symmetries of C with respect to A and B. Then you get this 3x3 Hamiltonian. You diagonalize it. You find that one of the eigenvalues is uninteresting. It's out of the region of interest. And the other two have this semi-Dirac behavior, which is plotted here. So this is the Brillouin zone right here. The energy scale has been pulled way down, so we can see the semi-Dirac points, but you can see the finite velocity along this direction and along the perpendicular direction. Then it's a quadratic dispersion relation right there. Okay. So I'm going to use the board so it didn't put the rest in PowerPoint. So what we have is that E of K is equal to plus or minus the square root of KX squared over 2M, some effective mass, but it's probably not greatly different than the electron mass in the solid, squared, plus BKY quantity squared, the square root of that. That gives the energy relationship right in the close proximity of this point. And you see that we have a natural momentum unit in the problem, which is the mass times the velocity, and therefore we have a distance unit. And in fact, if you scale K to be equal to K0, that's just equal to, I guess, T0 over H bar that I've defined here, times kappa. These two x and y components of wave vector, it is here, momentum, and multiplied by h bar, then this becomes plus or minus mv squared times the square root of 1/4 kappa x to the fourth plus kappa y squared. So you make the scaling, and unlike what I thought when I first looked at this, that you could change the velocity, keep the mass fixed, and you had a different sort of system here. When you make the scaling, everything comes out to an energy unit and dimensionless variables. Now, what one would like to do at this point, or one of the things one would like to do, of course, you can just start studying this system, residual interactions or effective impurities or quantum Hall edge states and so forth. Well, for quantum Hall problem, you have to think about introducing a magnetic field. So the momentum is going to take and add in the vector potential, like this. And if you try to do that in here, then you get momentum to the fourth power, the square root of that, and momentum is... Anyway, it's not very convenient, if possible at all, to have these momentum operators inside the square root operation. And what one can get this energy dispersion relation by considering a Hamiltonian, which has this form, and let's just forget about the units now, the energy unit. It's mv squared. So a Hamiltonian in terms of these dimensionless momenta, which is 1/2 kappa x squared, kappa y, and minus 1/2 kappa x squared. And the eigenvalues will be that. And now one can introduce the magnetic field into here and go about solving the 2x2 equation, so forth. But what I wanted to bring to the group of people who usually sit in here is the fact that here we have a system where the particles, the quasi-particles, behave differently in the forward and backward direction versus the left and right direction. In one direction, their energy versus momentum looks like k squared, and the other direction, it looks like k. And what might be the more general sorts of implications for such a system? It seems to be saying, in a sense, that actually the space is different in one direction than in the perpendicular direction. Or one could look at it that way and see if it's useful to look at it that way.
So Warren, I'm getting some remedial help here. So on one hand, we're thinking of these as points in k-space.
Well, the cap equals the k equals zero. In so here I've expanded around this Dirac point.
So it's near some point. So if we go too far, this will break down and look more like some band structure.
This is good for the low energy physics.
Okay. So it's just that's fine. So
it might be interesting for other people to look at it more generally. But for this particular system, this is good just at low energy and small momentum. Now, you also have this h kappa squared is equal to what we have up there. It's 1/4 kappa x fourth plus kappa y squared, which you can write as q dagger q. If you want, where q is equal to 1/2 kappa x squared plus or minus I kappa y. And whether one gets anything out by looking at this as sort of a square of this funny kind of operator, which very clearly distinguishes, again, in a little bit different way, the x from the y components of momentum. Another question is just, we've constructed this 2x2 matrix here, which gives the eigenvalues, but I don't yet have an idea of what sort of space we're thinking of here. In the diagonal components of the space, it is the energy along the x direction, the off diagonal, is energy along the y direction. So I don't yet know of an interpretation of just what this 2x2 space is. So I think that's what I wanted to put in front of a few people who are accustomed to thinking of perhaps funny spaces, like when you think about Andy de Sitter spaces, you have certain dimensions that behave differently than other dimensions, right? Not in this way, but this is a new sort of situation, perhaps, to investigate the implications of. So, yes, question, comment.
Right. So you're saying that this is massive in one direction and massive in the other, but the VKY, V is velocity, right?
Right.
So normally I wouldn't write velocity and momentum together. I would transform all of my velocities into momentum. So this term to me looks like V squared KY squared, which looks like KX squared plus KY squared all times KY squared. So it still looks like something that's...
Would it help if I wrote that? It's just some fixed...
It's a constant of the material.
Fixed by the universe, right. Yeah. The material in this case. But it's... So it's not a dynamic variable.
What
it's
sort of speeds... Maybe you mentioned I slipped, but... Are these...
It's...
Like speeds of sound in the material?
No. It's like speeds of electrons in solids. So typically, these speeds are 1/300th the speed of light. This might be 1,000th the speed of light, but it's about... Yeah, it's about 10 to the minus 3 to 3 times 10 to the minus 3 times the speed of light. Yes, Marcus.
Just one sort of comment. I mean, this is more exotic, but if you, the thing of getting a sort of quartic, whatever you want to call that, dispersion relation in that way in all directions is something that you can model in a relativistic system. This is something that Jacinta and I and Yumarakanihama and so on did under gross condensation. So there's some continuum, actually fundamentally relativistic thing that has that property. It doesn't have this anisotropy. But one thing there that's kind of interesting is that depending on your dimensionality, the counting of which operators are relevant and irrelevant is now completely changed, right? And so, one of the things that we found is that I think it was in the case of 3+1 dimensions, you have to worry about stability, for example, from relevant operators and things. And there was the next operator that you could write down that was generally allowed was just barely irrelevant. So this thing, this thing has just sort of barely made sense. So I think somehow in 3+1 dimensions. So I guess this is 2 dimensions. I'm trying to remember. Do you remember, Cynthia, how it goes for lower dimensions? And to do it. But I think it got... my memory was is that it was less stable in lower dimensions. So that's something that... I don't know if that's interesting to investigate or not.
Actually, I'm curious. So... You saw instabilities. How would they show up here?
Instabilities just meant that there's some relevant operator. And once you have a dispersion relation like this, you know how to do some power counting that basically tells you, if you write down higher interactions, you can think of this as there being some quasi-particle field, right, that is describing small excitations with this dispersion relation. And you can, if there's some operator is not forbidden by any symmetries, it's presumably going to be generated by your complicated material when you sort of make this quasi-particle, find out what is the correct quasi-particle action. And if that operator is a relevant operator, according to the scaling that you have, then this is probably inconsistent to be in this phase, unless you tune, right? Like a second-order phase transition, if you tune right near a second-order phase transition, you can have relevant effects that are going to zero right at a phase transition. But you seem to be finding that it's this is robust, right? This is robustly happening in this period.
This is robust.
So this would be a, that would be a, just a kind of consistency check of this sort of effective theory of small fluctuations with this crossing.
So this is robust in the sense of that if we just decide to change some things in the calculation here, this stays put at least for a while. It may move slightly along this line. It has to stay on this line.
Yeah.
But it's not sensitive to anything in the calculation that we know of.
Of course, I'm not saying that. I mean, we analyzed, we're in a different dimension. We're in an isotropic case. But I think there's a similar analysis that you can do that will tell you that the scaling, what the leading interaction is, that beyond this free propagation dispersion.
Is this the perturbative? So these bands you were showing us are theoretical calculations,
right.
And what are they, a perturbative calculation? Or?
No, they're not perturbative. They are, they involve approximations to an exchange correlation functional,
mm-hmm.
Not perturbative type approximations, but another kind. And as far as the dispersion relation goes, that is an effective mean field result to get these.
He's trying to think what the meaning of relevant and irrelevant operators in this context of this calculation would be. Usually it has to do with taking some, thinking about some emulator and all that. And is there some equivalent?
Well, you have a comment on that, or something?
No, I mean, I maybe I can think of one, but that wasn't very
So,
I have a comment. I mean, if you want the both to be quadratic, or just
or quartic?
Both quadratic. Were you thinking both quadratic or both quartic?
Well, we were looking at the case where both quartic.
Oh, both quartic. I see.
But that was an exotic case. Of course, the standard relativistic case is both quadratic.
Both quadratic relativistic case is the one that happens in graphene.
Right.
And in that case, there are lots of studies of stability with respect to various kinds of interactions. And it is stable, actually.
But that was sort of related
about
to
in the 3+1 dimensional case, with the quartic thing, there were real issues about whether there was some underlying theory that could give rise to that. Of course, we were constrained because, especially because we were coupling to Einstein gravity, we wanted something that was fundamentally relativistically invariant, so that it was easier here. But it still would be, is in a sense, a model for what we were considering for very different kinds of motivations.
So, maybe related to some of these questions, there are a couple of authors. I have their names here. At Ohio State, who considered doping of graphene, so you would have some electron states here occupied, say, considered, and then the Coulomb interaction between those, and actually did lattice gauge theory to get their result, and they find that in certain regions of doping, band filling, that it becomes an insulator from the lattice gauge theory calculation. But that's... Well, that's the sort of thing that people are looking at in graphene and will become interesting in these, or could become interesting in these materials also. So, Joe, you have a question.
Yeah, it was a little bit related to these comments. Is there any continuous change in the material that takes you from this to a graphene dispersion relation?
Ah, good question. I intended to mention that. Because for the first month, when we were discussing this, Rajiv and Swapnil and I kept wanting to take the limit where this becomes graphene. But no, it's just fundamentally different. You can't change any parameters here to get to graphene. It's a different kind of system.
But Ward, it's worth mentioning that the tight binding model that you had, if
yes.
there's a direct coupling between
yes.
the bands, it turns into a graphene-like structure.
Yeah.
There was an important point was that, he had these three bands, and the two important bands which are near the Fermi and they don't have any direct coupling with each other.
If you put in a direct coupling there, it turns it into a grapheme, which is purely direct link.
So that's sort of another thing we just discovered, that the graphene Dirac points shouldn't be that uncommon at all, really.
So, Rajiv, then if we turn on that coupling slowly, do we get this? Can you dial your way to graphene the way one wants to, or is it some sudden transition?
When you say change it slowly, you're now thinking of some dynamics? You're thinking of what happens?
No, I just think theoretically, you have your theory and you.
Well, the moment a sufficiently small k, the kx square is going to dominate over kx to the fourth.
Right. Here.
But you're raising an interesting question about dynamics. And if I have a system like this, people talk about these things in context of cold atoms. And in fact, there's a paper today on the web talking about such a system. What happens if you dial it to turn on that coupling somehow?
Yeah.
You know, what happens to the
just
state
along the lines of these
states
other questions
of anybody's
about,
system?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So presumably the transport in this kind of system should be quite a bit different than in either graphene or the usual kind of massive electronic systems we study, because these constant energy surfaces, which look like this, I have a picture I didn't concentrate on, like that, and of course they look, if you just look at any one of them, looks like an ellipse. But they vanish as a needle, as the ratio of the major to minor axis diverges as the energy goes to zero. So it's different than just an ellipsoid situation. Yes.
You mentioned that these were half metallic.
Yes. I don't know if I mentioned it. I didn't want to emphasize it, but yes, this case is. So, by half metallic.
So this is all only for one spin?
This, yes. So let me show you. This electronic structure in this region is just one spin, say spin up. Here is the density of states for spin up and spin down electrons, spin up and spin down. This is magnetic, it's ferromagnetic, and these states of interest right in here are just spin up states. There's a gap in the down spectrum that's called half metallic. So that's when one really gets to thinking particularly about this material, that's something to take into account. But again, it could happen in a non-magnetic system as well.
Warren?
Yes.
Why doesn't your system become not insulating, but it looks like a...
Right. It...
Is it
so Victor was doing LDA plus U calculations. In fact, this has a U on it because it seems like vanadium O2 should. It's a correlated material. But he increased U beyond where you would think, you know, upper limit would be. And it was not becoming mod insulator.
Oh,
and
is there any...
I'm not sure why.
A no experiment about the gap property of this material?
What is known, one of those references I didn't spend any time on, what has been done at 340 degrees Kelvin in the bulk, vanadium oxide undergoes a metal to insulator transition. It's a correlated metal above there, and it becomes insulating below, and also there's this atomic dimerization of vanadium ions, which is important to the transition, and that's still being studied a lot. But what these people found, one of these groups found, was that if the thickness of vanadium O2 was less than 5 nanometers, that transition didn't occur. The material stayed metallic, didn't become insulated. So since we're well in that region, it's appropriate to consider the metallic system here, if you call a single point friendly surface metallic.
But also in context of graphene, there are a lot of denormalization group type studies. But if you put in some Hubbard U, it's not like a square lattice. It doesn't immediately become an open solution. It is stable.
Okay.
There's another feature that I only started looking at a couple days ago, was some authors that have uncovered some supersymmetry in graphene. What their abstract says is that when you apply a magnetic field, then you get these energy levels that involve this cyclotron frequency, omega C. It's different than in ordinary materials, the way this behaves. But what they were saying is that these levels are degenerate with the Pauli paramagnetism, the 2 mu B B or 1 mu B B sort of energies, and that this degeneracy between the spin part and the orbital part leads to something which you can bring in supersymmetry to describe some of what's happening there. What?
The first one's a Landau level?
Sorry, the first one is
a Landau level?
Yes. It's interesting that the Landau levels usually go as n plus 1/2 h4 omega.
Mm-hmm.
See? In graphene, they go as square root of n h4 omega c. And in this system, they go as n to the 2/3. Is that right? Swap now?
Large n limit.
The only large n limit, which actually is not valid in this system, but in the model. This is large n limit.
Well, it's valid for small magnetic fields. You know, it depends on what limit you take in.
Right. For small magnetic field, you can make, you can bring this limit as low as you want, I guess. Mm-hmm. Right. Any further? Yes.
So, phonon also has a linear dispersion, right? And so, in graphene, it's electrons, but. Is there any reason why it's special? I mean, there was already a linear dispersion relationship in condensed matter.
Well, it's fermions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in systems where you can dope and change the chemical potential. With phonons, you don't have a chemical potential. There are certainly those differences.
You have a 3 vanadium layers in between, right?
Right.
So is that 3 is important, or 2 is enough, or
yes,
or
it's 3 is important because if there's just 2. I think if there's more than 3, then it just begins to be a half-metallic system, a half-metallic metal with a real Fermi surface. In other words, another band comes in here and disturbs things. And if there are just 2, I forget what Victor was getting. Maybe he was getting anti-ferromagnetic pairing to be lower energy. So the more or less specific size of this is important in producing just this sort of band structure. But they, it's still, I mean, even though you're saying that it has this sensitivity to the number of layers in between, we should still think of it as a two-dimensional system, and that changing the layers is somehow changing the couplings within the layer. Is that right?
Changing the unit cell.
Changing the unit cell, and yes, adding more interactions, adding more states.
Okay.
So another layer would put two more vanadium ions here, which would be two more of these yellow things show up here, and it would have, just have 33% more bands in this region, and one would have to calculate what they look like. There is, seems to be a little something interesting, specific maybe, about the symmetry of these states that are occupied, because our tight binding model involves, you know, A and B can't be coupled. If they have the right kind of symmetries with respect to each other, they won't be coupled. But they both have to be coupled to the third one. So we still have some things to learn about specifically what aspects of this situation are connected to the important aspects of the band structure. Okay, if there are no more questions or comments, there's no particular reason to hang around. If you care to think or discuss unusual dispersion relations like this, we'll be happy to look at them.